Well, it's me. Clarissa is not here, so and I would have been facilitating. Didn't expect such a low turnout, but hey, I will.
Yeah, there's something on like anti-globalization movement.
Ah, the hot, sexy subject.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, neither here nor there. I had some ideas. I just want to introduce myself. I'm Andrew Dinkelacker. I work for the United Electrical Workers Union. That's my job as an organizer and negotiator and so forth. I've done that for a number of years. I was going to be working with Clarissa, but Clarissa, we've had some things going on, so she's not here now, but it would have been me facilitating this. But I have a particular format that I would like to do with you all, and I'll run you through what that format is, and we can decide whether that's going to be effective or not, or however. One is I wanted to basically do like a free write at the beginning for like 10 minutes around a specific question, and I have a short presentation kind of addressing the connection between, say, consensus processes or decision-making and the anarchist tradition and how they are actually very linked together. And then after that, I would, if there's any questions of clarification in terms of a misunderstanding of what I actually said, not really a debating kind of questions, but just questions clarifying whether I might have misspoken something or mummered something and it wasn't clear, that's fine. And then I was suggesting a facilitated discussion, which doesn't necessarily have to be addressed to me. It can be addressed to anybody in the group, and I'll facilitate in terms of how you guys want to how you all want to speak and so forth. Depending on time and depending on your decision, it can be optional whether you want to do a second free write and then we wrap it up. Now, with time constraints and all, I kind of set for some specific times and stuff like that, and we can decide as to whether or not you want to continue in a particular thing. But as far as my part of, in terms of the presentation, I'm going to make sure I'm sticking to the 10 minutes, but everything else is pretty much negotiable in terms of how you want to proceed as a group or what's most exciting. So for the free write, what I have is a question. Basically, just asking, have you have any experience with consensus decision making or consensus processes? And for you to reflect and to think and to respond to that. And if the answer is no, a suggested question is, what attracts you to learning about consensus processes and/or attending this particular workshop? If the answer is yes, in what capacity? Were you a facilitator or were you a participant? So forth. And what were some of the positive aspects about? What were the negative? And you can determine how you want to, put whatever you want to put the emphasis on. These are the kind of the suggested topic to really think and reflect on before me introducing anything that I might have thoughts about. So if you have, I have paper here and pencils or stuff. So if you all want to take one or pass. All set?
Yeah.
Okay. After the free write, what I suggest is, what I want to do with it is I want to have them posted up there, which we can move somewhere else, but everybody who finishes with, say, they don't need 10 minutes to write this up, just post it up there. You can put your name to it if you want. That's optional. The only thing I do suggest is you just put a number 1 next to it in case it is decided to do a second free write, so that at least then you can get a sense of how the group has individually dealt with the issue before and kind of after. So I'll start now, and I'll give you a forewarning 2 minutes before the 10 minutes are up. I'm just going to move into the next section, which has to do with presenting basically thoughts that I have around renewing the anarchist tradition and how this interconnects with consensus decision making and stuff. I've written very extensively and very theoretically about it, and I don't have any time to go through a lot of the details and points of it, but I do have a website that has a lot of that stuff up and writings from other people about it. which I'll put on at the end if you're interested in checking that out. But what I did want to do was give a general kind of overview and kind of lead down to the past to how this actually is how I am really reflecting some things that have been said by previous anarchists and as something that's fundamental, at least the way I view it. You may disagree, and that's fine for having the discussion part. Originally, the title of the presentation that was to be in the booklet was, it started out with the question, who is renewing the anarchist tradition? And then it led to, and why we need consensus decision making and so forth. So I found, so when I came here, it was interesting that that part of the title was disappeared. But I think that's an important question. I leave that as kind of an opening question for, I think, everybody to think about in terms of our role in looking at anarchism and how it relates to us, inspires us, and who's, in fact, a part of this process of looking at that, as well as looking at what is the definition of renewing and how do we look at renewal. What I'm going to say is what renewal means to me. It may mean something different for you all, but that's part of the presentation. Renewing for me is really calling forth the basic principle that inspires writers and practitioners and theorists of anarchism for years and years to say, what draws me to think about this thing? And the principle that I pull out of that I have connected to very strongly and have seen throughout many of the writings and stuff is the principle of community and autonomy, of the combination of the two. It could be viewed or understood as unity and diversity. It could be understood as self-determination and social cohesion. But it's the idea of valuing each of those principles and seeing that they are in fact mutually reinforcing and in combination. And this is very different than the way mainstream political theory or most sociologists or organizational theorists or organizational practitioners view this question. These two values are seen as in conflict with each other in terms of being on a spectrum. On the one side, you have self-determination and individual rights. On the other side, you have social cohesion and a sense of community or society. And if the political theorist or whoever is working within this idea of these being in conflict, but yet they value both of these things, are going to see it as a seesaw. How can we balance these two values and make them work, make them compatible in such a way as we can then move forward as a society, a healthy society? Now, that's the traditional way that the framework that is used within political theory, that's used within organizational theory, and used in how people make decisions, how people interrelate. It's a conflict. What the anarchists have brought about, traditionally, a lineage of anarchists, talk about, is that these aren't two opposites of each other in conflict. They're, in fact, two separate values or principles with their own set of opposites. So if you look at self-determination, the anarchists assert that the opposite of self-determination is not community or a group, but it's the principle of someone else making decisions for you. So you're not in control. So you have a whole spectrum there of one principle. The other idea, the other value, is the sense of community. And here, the opposite isn't self-determination. The opposite of community is isolationism, is a sense of being radically independent, devoid of any social relationship or interrelationship with anybody, thing, or nature, or whatever, what have you. So as a result, the anarchists propose, and have asserted this for many, many years, that what we need to look at is how these two qualities of self-determination or autonomy is viewed supporting and enhancing community, and how community supports and enhances self-determination. That's what I sense as the renewal, as what we need to call forth from the past and kind of reapply to our current situation. One of the things is that for the anarchists back in two centuries ago now, since it's 1800s, you know, really viewed a threat to these two principles, or the combination of these two principles, is the state, you know, government. Today, it's less so the government, and it's more so multinational corporations or whatever kind of form or manifestation these institutions have evolved into, because clearly they haven't remained static from back in those days to today. They have evolved and changed into new forms, new creations. So the emphasis here is really to link how are these new forms, these new institutions, are in direct violation of these principles, and then assess tactics and strategies for that. So out of this primary idea of community and autonomy, the combination of the two, of mutually enhancing and supporting each other, comes a lot of secondary, or what I would call secondary, principles, and very important principles, such as a non-hierarchical society, building intimate relationships that are based on non-coercion, the idea of mutual association or voluntary association. So all of these kind of manifestations or principles, consensus decision-making falls within that as well. That all of these are an outgrowth of this core idea of these two are not seen as opposites but are in combination. So here's how they can be applied and so forth. So as the institutions change, then the view, by holding on to this basic idea, you can then think about, well, how does the idea of losing the sense of a town green, a public space, to a mall where it's a quasi-public space, but if you actually go in there with T-shirts boycotting certain products in the mall, you find out that you can't wear those T-shirts. They arrest you or kick you out. That you can't gather and actually have discussions or things like that, that you can. As well as the application of how the attacks on the internet, currently it's in a more free-form kind of space, but that it's going to evolve into a more capitalistic kind of pay-as-you-go internet in exchange. A perfect example is the fact that if you generate listservs and you want to send messages from your listserv and you're off of AOL and you want to send it to people on AOL, you can't. Your web server can send them, but AOL is censoring. It's just like as if the current post office down in Plainfield said, oh, we decided not to send you this mail. We're going to hold this mail. Now, of course, that would be considered an egregious violation. You're stealing my mail. But in its current form, in the current incarnation of the internet, nobody's thinking about that. And that's something that anarchists can really bring to these situations, is a sense of perspective on how is this violating, one, my ability to communicate with you and build a sense of community with you, as well as building or restricting me from being a complete human being, from being fully, you know, self-actualized, to be all I can be. So that's the excitement that anarchism actually brings, and is in fact not limited by tactics or strategies, just because capitalism or whatever the current dominant form does changes itself. It's constantly renewing, bringing it back to this basic principle and saying, how do we evaluate this situation according to that principle? So what I looked at then is, here's a basic principle: community and autonomy in collaboration with each other, supporting each other. It begs the question, are there social organizations that we can create that allows for this to be simultaneously optimized, to be reinforcing to the degree that it just keeps building on each other, that you keep growing as an individual, community keeps growing, and you keep growing on top of each other? And so when you look at that, again, it goes back to the anarchist tradition that it is possible. That's what we've been saying. That's what anarchists have been saying all along. It is possible to build a society that is grounded in the collaboration of these two principles. And the way that I've looked at it, they tend to be, these organizational forms tend to be deeply or directly democratic, based on certain kind of decision-making processes and procedures that ensures the protection of those two principles. And that leads me to consensus-like processes that, as a container for protecting these two principles and ensuring that the group and the individual are constantly on guard against when are we being subverted to coercive activity, to being manipulated, to all sorts of scenarios where all of a sudden domination comes into play, sexism comes into play, classism comes into play. If the organization is continually reminded and has organizational processes that hold us to that, then that is the what anarchism offers, is connecting how direct democracy as an organizational form, deeply democratic with specific consensus-like processes, meets these conditions, or is the best container so far to meet these conditions, and is the closest thing to an anarchical society that we have yet. It doesn't mean that there isn't more to go beyond that, but that's how it connects together there. So what I've done was to take a look at consensus decision-making and to say, or consensus processes, and to say, well, what are we talking about in terms of viewing it in relationship or in evaluation to community and autonomy, community and self-determination? Does consensus do that? Is it, in what form does consensus do that? So what I look at there is proposing, well, that leads individuals to ask questions about, well, how is the agenda set? For example, I set an agenda here. I set the times. I was in control of all of that. You know, it leads you to ask questions in terms of how decisions are being made. It leads you to ask questions in terms of how people are participating. Is there natural constraints? For example, in this kind of environment, I'm currently the person standing up. I'm currently considered an authority, or could be deferred to as an authority. That doesn't mean you have to agree with me or anything like that, but that's traditionally how it's viewed. A discussion environment may be inclusive of some people who are readily easy or have a much better time at speaking out, speaking in public, than, say, individuals who are better at one-on-one, having a discussion one-on-one with somebody. So are we, in fact, encouraging people to inclusive of that? So it really causes you to examine your behavior. So it really defines consensus more than simply a voting procedure on a spectrum of different voting or decision-making options. It looks at consensus as a relationship, as an interrelationship. So consensus is an interrelationship. It views it as valuing community and self-determination, community and autonomy. So rather than as a voting mechanism. So that forces you to start looking internally at your own kind of things. Am I encouraging people within the group to participate? Or am I participating and creating a supportive environment for people to speak out or speak their mind? Or am I being an obstacle to that? Are there things that the group's doing to me? And have I brought that up? Or where can I bring that up? So it starts to really to reframe the question of how consensus works within a group environment. So, and this is intimately connected to the two principles that I've, you know, brought forth, you know, of community and autonomy and the combination of the two. That's my thoughts. That's what I've been thinking about and have connected together with. Are there any questions of clarification about, you know, if there was a point that didn't, whatever. If not, we can go into a facilitated discussion, which is fine, too. I'll, you know, leave a second for some quiet on this.
Okay. Thank you. We're making copies of videos. We have to go stop it and start next one.
Sure.
Okay.
All right. Then I suggest, you know, we just break it down into like a discussion, and, you know, we can facilitator for, I can, you know, make sure that, well, I mean, it's not going to be hard to figure this out. I mean, I don't have to facilitate, I can just participate too. I mean, I think we can self-regulate this in terms of ensuring everybody speaks, so.
So I guess one question I have is, what do you think about the criticism that a lot of people and anarchists in particular have of consensus, being that people oftentimes feel coerced or pressured to come to consensus, and that people in effect lose their autonomy because there's lots of pressure to, you know, either stand aside or consent?
Well, I can respond to that, but I wondered if anybody had thoughts too or wanted to bring up stuff too. If not, I'll respond.
It's a question I've had also. It's been my experience.
Something I've read, I don't know that I've seen it in practice, actually, but the point is not to have everybody agree, and that you're supposed to be bringing out different, if you're doing it right, which maybe, you bring out the different opinions and see where people stand, and coming up with something that everybody can live with.
If you want.
No, go ahead. Okay. Separate thoughts.
One way to look at this is to look at, does consensus work? I mean, are we talking about a pie in the sky kind of thing, or does it actually work? And I know for myself, my personal experience, I've been through group processes where there wasn't a sense of coercion. Maybe those individuals who brought that up as an argument have experienced that. It's not to deny that that doesn't exist, but that in fact, that the possibility and that in fact occurs is something very distinct from saying that we're talking about a process that has never worked, but we're going to try it anyway. Now, I can see making an argument that way. So the second part would be to look at it in terms of, well, if a person is feeling coerced, then I wouldn't say it is a consensus process, because the group as a whole and the people that are facilitating it aren't being aware of the fact that coercion is coming about, in terms of saying, aren't you siding with me? It's time. And that kind of devolves into kind of a voting status where I have a proposal and we're going to dismantle your proposal because we don't like it. So let's try and get as much support as we can on our side until we beat everybody into agreement. Now, there's a distinction, I think you were making it, which is there's a distinction between unanimity and unity. Unanimity means that you force everyone into a particular mold and they all look the same. The unity is the fact that you're bringing people together. They're going to walk into this situation different and they're going to walk out of the situation different. So you can come about a sense of, this is how we're going to move forward as a group. Yes, there might be people that disagree. Then we handle that as they come up. But I would return the question to say, is that argument brought up to argue against the principle that consensus decision making is based upon, which is the combination of community and self-determination? Or is it against the fact that in this particular situation, consensus decision making is not working as a procedural or a logistical question?
I've had some negative experiences with consensus process breaking down. Supposedly consensus-based groups where it wasn't actually working that way. I don't want to go into the ugly details. That would take too long. But just people who'd been in the group a long time and did a lot of work. In one case, the person was a staff person, sort of abusing their influence to get their way. In one case, the person said he disagreed with what we decided on, but he was going to stand aside, and then just went ahead and did what he wanted, disregarding the consensus decision and making it unworkable. One thing I realized from this is that there's only so much procedures that you've got written down on paper can do if people aren't willing or aren't mentally able to work in that process. The other thing that's come up with me is like, okay, we've got some people because they're coming into this process from this screwed up society we have and they're emotionally damaged or whatever, don't seem to be able to work with it. how do we work with them? I mean, okay, yeah, we can kick them out of our group, or we can try and have the group fall apart. But that seems like something that should be a last resort, and I've got no idea how to go about working with those people, but I'm wondering if anybody has any ideas how to work with somebody who's, like, emotionally wounded, can't work by consensus because of that, but, you know, is part of the group.
My experience in working with consensus is an environmental work study group that I belong to in Hampshire College, where I go to school, and, yeah, in some instances, it got really personal. You know, we'd have a bunch of people who... We basically got thrown into working with consensus. It was something we inherited from past group leaders, and it's just decided that we would work by consensus, but nobody officially agreed upon it. So I think we're all thrown into it without a background in it. But people who didn't know how to state their concerns briefly, who didn't know how to stay on topic without wandering off on the topics we'd already discussed or that we were getting to, and people who were so uncomfortable with any sort of power that they wouldn't take on a strong facilitator role to rein people back in. And it did, it got personal. You know, we tried to say, you know, please keep your comments to 2 minutes. And, you know, after saying that over and over again, the person started to feel alienated. Oh, I have lots of questions about consensus. But that's been my experience. So, you know, is there a way to keep the personal out of it? I don't know.
Don't know that you want to keep the personal out of it. It's like the type of personal it gets. I mean, what you want ideally is to be everybody to be bringing their own wisdom to the situation. I mean, that's the Quaker formulation. That's where consensus comes from. But the idea is that, you know, everybody has a piece of the puzzle. Can we fit the pieces together? I think the problem is like when it gets nasty type personal, when people don't know how to be respectful or even just know how to listen.
And I guess that's some of the concerns. Yeah, people didn't know how to listen. People didn't know how to respectfully disagree. There's just so much background I feel that people need in order to come into it. Yeah, this is only my experience, one experience, one place. But
Where I work at a state library in Connecticut. And it's still a government office situation. It's still pretty much your standard, you know, compartmentalized structure. You still get orders from above to say, do this, do this, do this, this year. But they've been doing some experiments with having sort of groups, working groups that organize their little parts of the tasks among themselves and figure out how it's going to get done. And one of the things that we've done in terms of training is we've had trained people who know how to teach people these techniques, or at least get them into the mindset of cooperating rather than competing against their coworkers.
Right.
So they started off with that, teaching like little lessons. My favorite is birds. You have everybody in the class try to write down how many birds can you think of in the next 1 minute, and you write them down. Okay, now you tally out all the numbers, and you know some people are really good at it, some people aren't, and then they say, okay, groups of four. Now add them together and see what more you can come up with. And then the numbers suddenly get big. Because you might know a lot of raptors and I might know a lot of songbirds. Put them together, you get a lot more birds. Just sort of techniques of showing people that, yes, you can actually get somewhere by putting your heads together and cooperating. So some sort of background teaching, especially when you've got a lot of new people coming to it the first time, might be helpful. And I don't know if that's something that you have experience with. But also, one of the other things we do with facilitators is when we started out, we made it really clear what the role of the facilitator was. And we had somebody from outside our department. In fact, at first we had somebody who wasn't even a librarian or in the library at all. It was from another part of campus. In the personnel department, come in and be the facilitator, keeping us on time and making sure that everybody got a chance to talk, they had something to say, keeping comments limited, keeping us on target with what we were trying to do. So that way it's not personal, because it's not somebody you've been working with for 15 years and have all these little personal grudges with. So after a while of learning that, we would rotate the role. You know, it wouldn't necessarily be the coordinator or the person who's sort of like the chair of that committee. It would be somebody else. And then they would do it for a while. I mean, I imagine there's many combinations. you could rotate it every meeting. You could have them do it for 6 months, whatever. So maybe this would not only be good for networking between different organizations, but you might want to get somebody who's not in your group to come and facilitate your group if there's some affinity between the two and they're going to cooperate properly.
That's very doable. It's a very good idea. Thank you.
Go back to my question. I guess to point out how it would be fundamentally coercive is that with consensus, everyone, or at least the majority of the people, go into the process hoping to seek consensus. They all generally have the same goal of consensus. And so you could say that there's always a force or pressure or coercion of some sort to reach consensus simply because most people are going into the process with that goal in mind. And it might be the pressure of conformity more than that of authority, but it's still a pressure, which one could say is coercive.
Right. The way I look at what was helpful for me, not that it's a solution or anything, but a helpful way of evaluating, say, group situations and how they arise. Many times people are unaware of what principle they may favor versus the other, and they see it as a versus. Like, the whole individuality versus community is another classic way of doing it, and because as long as they continue to see it as a fight between the two, then their dynamics that they bring into an interpersonal relation or a group relation is gonna say, well, we're more about community, meaning that we want to get everybody to agree, so they're going to wait. Their perspective, their view is going to be weighted towards community and not really understanding how by weighting it that way, weighting it so heavily on this end, you may in fact be violating a person's individuality or autonomy. And the other extreme is that a person that so entirely just views, hey, I gotta make sure I say what I'm going to say. And everybody better listen kind of thing, you know, this kind of self-assertion to the point, like, maybe it's the first time they really are experimenting and doing this. But they're doing that to the degree that there's no recognition of, well, how does this relate to being a part of a group or anything like that? So what the anarchist perspective brings is the balance in saying of not balance, but saying that the two are mutually enhancing, not mutually exclusive. Meaning you can't have one without the other. Whereas traditionally it's viewed you can have one without the other. It's a matter of finding the happy medium. So the anarchists are when they're sitting in a group dynamic situation, they may in fact notice someone that is aggressively self-assertive, wants to make sure they're heard, or whatever. And one of the things that, as an anarchist, you approach it, you say, hey, that's probably where their development is going at this point. What we bring into it then is relating what that person is doing to how does that become part of the collective, if it can become part of the collective. It doesn't say that just because everybody comes together as a group that we must be this group from now until we die. It's groups come and go. So it really talks about that emphasis. And one of the pitfalls of group dynamics and things like that is that you might walk into it with the sense of consensus, or people say, yeah, we're going to operate according to this idea, but they lose sense of the fact that the consensus is built on these two principles supporting each other, rather than consensus, we got to all agree, that's what consensus means. No, it does not mean that. It means everybody finds their place in the group, and out of that comes whatever the next movement is. I mean, the Quakers are very familiar with that in terms of their meeting style and so forth. And they in fact view consensus as a degeneration of their sense of the meeting, as they call it. They call it the sense of the meeting. So it's very interesting when you start to look at these two qualities and you say, well, is the group overall supporting these two principles, or are we mainly hearing from those that advocate for community, or are we mainly hearing from those that advocate vetoing everything that comes up because they disagree? So it's not as though narrows down and settles into a final result, and that's the end-all, be-all, it's then understood as a procedure, a process, an interpersonal process. I might change my mind tomorrow. I might change my mind next week. But it's a question of, where do we feel comfortable now? Do we feel comfortable enough that, hey, I don't need to be directly involved in every aspect of this particular decision, but there, if there's something that's brought up down the road, then I'm going to be involved, and the container of the organization allows for someone to come in and to do that. But again, it's going to all be evaluated on whether, one, it enhances kind of group cohesiveness and sense of direction, as well as enhancing everybody developing as individuals. That's the music. That's the dance. That's the sense of direction. That's how I kind of looked at a lot of that.
I don't know if this is something that would really be considered consensus, but I remember a couple of years ago I read some little article about decision making in small groups, and the idea was to kind of avoid an all or nothing opposition where people might say, well, this is a terrible idea and I don't want to have anything to do with it. How do you discern that from somebody who's like, well, this should be changed, but then I'll go along with it? And the idea was, most people have five fingers on their hands, so it's kind of like a vote, like a weighted vote. If you really like the idea so much that you're willing to actually make it happen, you give it a 5. If you like the idea, you give it a 4. Mm-hmm. You really don't care, you give it a 3. If you generally like it, but there's one or two things that you think need to be changed, you give it a 2. And if you want nothing to do with it and you don't think it's a good idea at all, you give it a 1. And the idea is it gives more nuance to the vote, and you can see more clearly where people are, and you can also sort of distinguish the people who really want to get involved and do it themselves, and the others who might not really want to do it but think that it's okay for the group overall to have their name attached to. And distinguish them from the people who think that's a really bad idea and give them a chance to explain, well, why are you so vehemently against it? Mm-hmm. And maybe, change the sense of the group later on. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, would that be considered consensus, or is that more like voting? Or
I mean, it's like, people do consensus all the time. To understand it as something that's distinct or something that happens only in this corner of the room, is a wrong view to have. I feel, because if, say, the group of us decide, hey, we want to hang out tonight, well, we've just agreed on, hey, let's continue keeping the group going. Well, that's a consensus, in a sense. Now, the decision to go to the movies, say, we all might agree, we might all have our different preferences, but we might all land down on the fact that, hey, this movie, I'd enjoy sharing that experience with you, even though I alone might not have chosen to go to that movie. That's very different, arriving at going to something like that. Or the example might be is that us three might decide to go to this particular movie, and you two say, no, I'm not really interested in that, and there's only two movies to pick, and you're more interested in the other movie, so we agree, well, let's break apart, go to the movies, and reconvene again. Well, you've just made consensus yet again on something, even though you didn't necessarily keep the identity specifically the same the whole way through. Now, that's very different than going to, I'll refer to the weighted votes a little bit, but that's very different than, say, doing majority rule. Now, what if we had done majority rule? Well, we would have won the majority, and we could have forced you to go there, which might have ethically been against you because it was about, whatever the movie was about, you just did not like at all. Well, that's what consensus does, is it doesn't allow for the legitimation through a special procedure to coerce people. See what I'm saying? Whereas majority rule is like a magic wand where it says, okay, everybody, we're going to do majority rule. Bam! Now it's okay to coerce this minority into doing this. And everybody considers it okay. Whereas consensus, if it's truly honored, based in the anarchist kind of tradition and the principles of self-determination and community, there will be people that will say, you can't do that. Sorry. That's just wrong. And maybe a decision isn't made on that. But what it forces is it forces people to fundamentally assess their behavior and the group's behavior to, are we violating people's sense of self-determination, and are we violating our sense of social cohesion? You know, so that's what this kind of that's why I define or refer to consensus as a process of interrelationship. Whereas that interrelationship may lead to voting. You may all agree that we want to do a voting on this particular item. It's not that important. That's an easy way of doing it. Fine. You might, in fact, all agree to do majority vote on something like that because it's not that important. It's not that relevant to kind of have everybody intimately figure that out. But if it's a more serious issue or more serious problem, then I would think that there's going to be a greater need amongst the folks participating in the group to want to make sure that everyone is included. And if there's people that are just out and out against, then the group's going to have to think, well, is this a time they might identify and say, hey, this is an instigator. We got it. This is a police infiltrator. What are we going to do? Well, you kick them out. But you all know that, knowing full well that, yes, you are violating that person's self-determination, but that person's self-determination is specifically involved in this particular group to destroy the group. So see how it's a counter-violation and, you know, things like that. So you're not behaving in this way to say that, oh, it's legitimate for us to do so. You know that you're departing from those principles, but that you're... goal as a group is to continue rather than legitimizing it. Because one way of legitimizing would be, let's just do it by majority rule. Majority will rule that you're out. You know, there might have been a couple other people that disagree. We don't want to kick them out. Well, then we have a problem there. You know, so, you see what I'm saying? Then it legitimizes that we have power over this person. That's a big difference, is whether or not the procedure is designed to legitimize the violation of these ideas, these values.
So one knock I hear against consensus all the time, and in my experience, mm-hmm. is that it takes forever. That, you know, little decisions where if we just voted on them and majority rules, you know, we'd be done with it, okay, we'd be on to the next thing. And when you're faced with, you know, in our example, an hour-long meeting, and you say you have, you know, five decisions that you have to make, and you will only get to two of them. And so, you know, the decisions get, you know, pushed on to the next week. You know, I was just wondering, has anybody in their experience figured out how to deal with it? Oh, huge question. I'm sorry.
I haven't had experience, but somebody was once telling me, I'd mentioned that, you know, I like consensus, but sometimes it took forever. Yeah. And he said, this was through Nutbombs Boston, we'd set up, a meal right outside a building that was about to be demolished so they could gentrify the neighborhood. And the cops weren't particularly taking a liking to this. And he said the people there, you know, the cops had come along and told them to move. And they'd come to a consensus decision without even saying anything. They just looked at each other, knew where they were coming from. I don't remember what they decided. But I remember that story more than anything else. And if you read about tribal societies, it seems like often it works that way when they're making consensus decisions. They don't need to have anybody say, do we have consensus? They know intuitively. And I think that's something, as we sort of move forward with building a new society, we have to relearn.
I guess another idea is just time limits, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Dividing it so that a meeting won't take forever.
Hasn't worked. We tried. I mean, I guess part of our problem. Well, I don't know.
Oh, great.
Just quickly, it's a very diverse group of people. Not necessarily, you know, racially, but from different backgrounds. You know, people coming from, you know, growing up in anarchist communes to people who very middle class background to, you know, sons of bankers. I mean, there's just so many different ideas roaming around that. Our group specifically had a very hard time ever deciding on anything. So, mm-hmm. I don't know.
One of the things that I would have stated something similar along those lines and thought about time limits. I mean, a lot of the things really just come up as suggestions. They're mainly tactical or logistical kind of mm-hmm. concerns, but it also comes down to, you know, well, you ask questions like, well, how does everybody view the questions that do come up, that decisions need to be made on? Are they more kind of like, well, you know, not to use the term business, but are they more kind of business procedural kind of questions that need to be answered, kind of like administrative questions that need to be dealt with on a daily basis? Does everybody in the group really need to be involved?
Yeah.
Well, you pose that as a question. The group can talk about that and you can evaluate, because I think the frustration you're experiencing as far as is something that others in the group are also experiencing. It clearly isn't something that's just, oh, I'm the only one feeling this way.
No, it's the whole group.
but the difference is how do you then deal with it as a group? So my suggestion would be is to make sure that the group is saying, well, if we're going to do anything to address this problem, we're going to do it in a way that honors these two qualities, that we all have the ability to be self-determining and that we're maintaining a sense of group identity and building our sense of community. So letting that out is saying that's the framework that we're going to try and solve this particular question. Then a discussion comes out of that. We don't know what the answer is going to be. None of us do. But it's a matter of expressing those points of view and saying our goal really isn't so that we're just going to have meetings all the time. Our goal is to move forward as an organization. Right. So it takes it away from, you know, focusing on, God, you know, even if we have majority votes too, we'd still have a lot of decisions to make. So you start thinking about, well, we're interacting as a group. There's problems to be dealt with. There's issues to be solved as we go. And there's all sorts of books and manuals out. The interesting thing about the majority of the books and manuals out on consensus decision making or different forms of decision making is that they don't do it from the anarchist perspective of how are these closer to or more in violation of the anarchist notion of a good society, you know, of unity and diversity and things like that. So when you walk in and read those books, you can read it through that lens of, all right, if they use that, would this be honoring this more than that? Or, you know, and that's how you can evaluate different things, and that's how suggestions come up, and that's how people have discussions of it. Sometimes it does come down to being a more of an intuitive thing, but what it does do is it forces people to really think about who they are and how they're involved in the group. You know, what am I bringing to the group? Am I bringing a lot of baggage? You know, someone's going to call me on it. You know, if that's the case, doesn't mean that that's wrong, but it means that there's some work that needs to be done on the individual level in order to be more productive at the group level and to offer more so that the total amount of whatever is brought to the group is greater than the sum of its parts. That's what we're seeking to encourage. So if someone has a real difficult time expressing themselves in the group, well, of course, we're going to talk about how can we improve those skills so that people, newcomers, come into a group. How do we get them up to speed? So you think of things outside of when we're actually going to make a decision and think of what's going to help reinforce building, when we come together as a group, building these two conditions, these two qualities. I don't know what the content of the group is going to be, but it really encourages that. So you think beyond coming together as a group. There's many things. As soon as I leave this meeting, this so-called meeting here, you know, I could be talking with you. Hey, you brought up some really good ideas, you know, whatever, da-da-da-da. Or I really can sense a lot of concern from you. And that's a one-on-one. We're talking about, you know, is there more anger coming out of this particular thing that meets the eye? Or, you know, but it allows for the expression of these kind of feelings and emotions. It might not always be relevant, and I think some people feel like it has to be efficient. And that's a mindset of a capitalist society, because capitalism is all about efficiency combined with profits. We want to be efficient. And efficiency has nothing to do with interrelationships. To interrelate with somebody, it's messy as all hell if I was to look at it economically, you know? But that's not, the point isn't so we can become efficient, the point is so we can become more human. I mean, I want to go to work to be human, not so that I'm an automaton. You ask anybody, it doesn't matter if they're an anarchist or not. They can't disagree with the fact that they want to be self-determining, they want to be a full human being, and they can't disagree that they don't want to be interacting with other people like that. And making decisions like that. There's no way that they can disagree unless they're unless you uncover them and they say, no, I prefer being a dictator. I prefer telling people what to do. Then you know where they stand. Then you know that no matter what you do with that particular individual, you're not going to get anywhere in terms of trying to build the sense of community, the sense of society that you're going to have. And you're going to meet people like that. I'm sorry. It's just reality. But it makes it more frank in terms of where people are coming from and where they stand. And that's scary because it calls for more intimacy. It calls for more expression of human emotions. And it calls for you being in touch with your feelings. I mean, a lot of people don't do that. And especially in our particular culture, we are conditioned to act alone, to be understood as that there are heroes, that there are authorities, and that they are in control. Either you're going to be a leader or you're going to be a follower. You choose. And that's it. It has nothing to do with collaboration, any of that stuff. So it isn't surprising when you try and introduce this that this is, in fact, one of the most radical things you can perhaps introduce into a group situation is let's actually be together, you know? You know, and that's what some of the 60s were all about. I mean, there were encounter groups and all that kind of stuff. But, I mean, it was an experimentation, an exploration of how are we going to interact. And in a functional way, it's how do we interact to make decisions that affect our organization. You know, it's very, very challenging.
Wondering, what do you think of these two different spin-offs of the consensus? One is a common preference finding, the other sociocracy.
I am not familiar with either.
Tell me all about it.
Oh, okay. Well, this the first one, common preference finding, I'm familiar with from this radical parenting philosophy called Taking Children Seriously. Uh-huh. I can give you the website address. It's sure. And they also put out a journal. It's basically about they talk about it mainly in relation to kids, but they also talk about autonomy respecting relationships, where basically the goal is to use creativity, because creativity would be necessary, to just see what exactly are the people involved prefer, what do they want, and the thing is to find the sources of that want. What do they really want? Like, someone may say they want something, but they have actually deeper want for something else, some deeper sense of whatever. Right. And the trick with common preference finding is to basically, as it says, find common preferences, you know, find some solution or some decision or whatever that meets what everyone actually prefers and wants. And it may be totally different than what's proposed, you know, maybe it may turn out that what people really want is something else, and it may be totally off the wall, but that's why you need creativity. I'm actually a lot into common preference finding and TCS, taking children seriously. The other one, sociocracy. There's definitely books about this and somewhat of a movement of that emerging. I think it got started in Denmark or something. It's kind of like consensus plus some anarchist structures plus bureaucracy.
That sounds interesting. Yeah.
It uses a lot of consensus practices and stuff, but at the same time, it also has some kind of positions of like elected representatives, but the representatives could be overruled in any decision they want by anyone in the organization. And it's made for big organizations and stuff. And I think in Denmark, where it got started, there's some companies or stuff that got started that use this process and all that.
I'm sorry if I interrupted that.
Heard of it?
No, I haven't heard of it, but that isn't... The name is new to me, but the way you defined it is something that's very common. It's what you can call nesting. That's a mathematical way of saying it, but it's also a different way, which is...
This is the sociocracy? Or
yeah, so both. It could be both.
Okay.
It could be both. What it says is what is the overall context that you're operating within? For example, I use computers. That's an easy one. You can have all sorts of programs for the computer, but the overall system is ruled by what? Either Microsoft Windows or something else. So that's the biggest frame where everything sits within is Microsoft, if you have that particular type of computer, and then you have the programs within it. Now, depending on what Microsoft does to their overall Windows application can affect the programs inside in terms of how they function, whether they can interact with each other, and so forth. So if we apply it to, say, decision-making or interpersonal procedures or things like that within organizations, you have to ask the ultimate question of who, in fact, where does the buck stop? Does it stop with, say, if I take a school, for example, does it stop with the community, meaning a composition of everybody within the school, or does it stop with the board of trustees and the president? So within a traditional institution, there can, in fact, be pockets of committees and substructures where consensus decision-making is operating all the time, and, in fact, very well. The difficulty is that if by chance anything that they actually act on is at odds with those that are pretty much on the outside the largest frame, then that decision is going to be overruled. So it's basically everything is fine in paradise as long as we don't disrupt the gods, basically. So in a sense, you're not, all the decisions you make, you're not going to be disagreeing with them until they tell you you can't do that. And they're going to be the ultimate authority on that. So that is very common. And what an anarchist could do in that situation, or someone that is familiar with honoring those two principles of community and autonomy, is to say, okay, if we make a decision, how is us making this decision, can it be overruled by some other group? And how can it be overruled? Can we change that? So even though you have to continue, you can't just simply wipe out everything and start from scratch, because we're all live within existing institutions. But we can ask the questions of, is all the work we're doing going to be thwarted by some outside force? For anarchist groups, that might be great within the anarchist group in terms of doing consensus decision-making, but there are forces that limits many times what's going to happen because, well, the government just came in, took our land, or, the police arrested us and stuff like that. And so it's a matter of then identifying how those conditions, whatever they may be, limit us from doing these kind of interactions through consensus decision-making or consensus processes, prevent us from having interrelationships that way.
You mentioned a while about, being okay to kick somebody out if they were obviously a police agent. I'm still wondering about the experiences I've had with people who I know are not police agents but are still completely screwing up the organization. Mm-hmm. And there seems to simply to be no way to working with them. And I think part of the problem with these two things is both there was, even though they're supposed to be egalitarian groups, these people had a disproportionate amount of power, which they were abusing, but I don't know, it seemed to go beyond that simple abuse of power of I want to be dictator. It seemed to be like I am messed up in the head and don't realize it. Mm-hmm. And it might have helped in both situations if we'd realized at the time we needed to bring it out in an outside mediator. But I don't know how much that would have done, given the fact that I think these people just couldn't listen. Like, one of them was a very nice guy, actually. I like him. He just couldn't listen to anybody. He was the staff person and considers himself, I am the professional staff person. Professional organizer. I know it's good for the organization. I don't care what the volunteers who are supposedly in charge of the organization think. And I am still trying to figure out how we could have dealt with those situations better, because the results in both situations were really ugly. I no longer work with one of the groups, and I'm still trying to figure out why I'm working with the other one.
Yeah. One way is, call it ostracism, but one way is reconstituting the group. That's another way of saying it. To reconstitute the group. The clear thing is that how does the decision to reconstitute the group come about? Well, if it's clearly a disruptive situation, regardless of whatever the motivation is, there are then questions that are brought up as the group saying, look, we've been having difficulties reaching decisions, and they, people are going to call it out and say, this is mainly because we're experiencing it from this one particular individual. You know, it could be a group of individuals. I don't know. But the thing is it forces then drawing out what is in fact occurring, that everybody's talking under their breath. If I was doing majority rule or some other process, it's always going to be, let's count the votes in order to avoid not talking about the real issues at hand, which is so-and-so is really not caring about anybody but is still active in the group. Whereas what consensus does is it forces people to really examine themselves and the group process. Is it going to be easy? No, absolutely not. It doesn't mean that it's any easier than any other form, but what it does mean is that you're honoring those two principles and you're struggling as a group how to do that. Does that mean it's going to be perfect? No. But it means that there's an attempt made by the group to address the issue or the obstacle in terms of moving together as a group, but moving together in a way that continues to honor that idea of self-determination and community building. So, you know, there are many suggested logistical or tactical kind of exercises that are in manuals and books and things like that that could be then spread on the floor and say, hey, here's a whole bunch of different ways that we can experiment with how to get beyond this blockage. Otherwise, the only other thing we have is we're going to have to just continue to grin and bear it and not function really well. So, but it allows for the organization and for the individuals to really come face to face with that. Then people are going to make decisions. Do I want to continue with this or do I want to leave this situation? But those kind of decisions are made with the sense of, you know, I'm doing it because I want to do it, you know, or I'm leaving because I want to leave. And, you know, so that's out of a respect for the sense of self rather than, well, we have this procedure, which is called Robert's Rules of Order, and we're going to do it this way. Tough. Until you get enough votes to do it another way, tough. You know, and that's very, it's a very constricting, and it doesn't allow for the spontaneity to really arise. It doesn't allow for people to find out where they are, and it doesn't mean that once they're identified that people are going to say, oh, thank you for telling me that. I am now going to go work on that. No, that doesn't mean that either. But it presents those opportunities, and then it's up for the people to really that are involved in that to decide, well, we brought this up. The person clearly doesn't care about making any movement in any way, whether it's on, you know, whether it's as a group, part of the group, or seeking out, you know, talking with people one-on-one outside of the group situation. Then the group's got to decide, does everybody agree that this person isn't helping us and he ought to at least take a time out from our organization for a year and come back? You know? Who knows? I don't know. But at least then it's done in the sense of, look, we're respecting the identity of the group, but we're also respecting all the participants', you know, sense of self-determination and autonomy. And does that mean that you're always going to be on that road? No. It's walking the road that's important, not that you're, you know. That's life, I guess. That's the way I experienced it. I mean, that's not that I'm thinking that that's a solution, but that's the struggle. And I think that's what the anarchist tradition offers as a very inspirational and potentially creative and, you know, has the most potential solution is processes that encourages this kind of intimacy, this kind of interaction that's on a real heartfelt sense. Yeah, I might be a bigot, but then we're going to talk about that, you know? We're going to bring it out, you know? And if I change, I change. If I don't, I don't. But it's brought out, and the group has to recognize the reality of that, you know? And that to me is where a lot of the real work takes place. And there's not, and so you don't need a lot of theory for that, actually. You don't. You ask the two questions. Hey, is this respecting that person for what they are? And is this respecting what we're trying to do as a group? Evaluate on that. Are we weighing more than one or the other? Well, if we are we doing that because we're trying to compensate for something? Because you might do that. An organization might stress more unity than self-determination at a particular moment because that's what's needed. at that moment. They're encountering attacks from all sides in terms of questioning the organization and funding is being lost or things like that. So it's it's very interesting how it's much more living, much more organic that way. I think we're out of time. Thank you all for
this. That's very helpful. I got a lot of good ideas out of it.
Yeah.